Welcome back to the Physician's Guide to Doctoring. On this week's episode, we have a guest host. So please be the same respectful audience you are for me and enjoy.
This episode is brought to you by Heidi. Imagine kicking back while a HIPAA-compliant AI scribe writes your soap notes for free. Yes, you heard us right. Heidi is free. I'm Dr. Tom, Heidi's CEO and founder, and we started Heidi to stop clinicians wasting their life on clinical documentation. Heidi transforms your consult babble into crisp, clear soap notes, personalizing itself with every edit. One day, Heidi will be your AI resident, looking through research, explaining plans, and doing anything you don't want to. If you currently pay for an AI scribe in your practice, you should swap to Heidi. We'll even credit you for anything you've already paid. Dive into the description for the link and make your practice the envy of every stethoscope in town. Sign up and watch Heidi work its magic all for free because you've got better things to do.
Welcome everyone. I'm your host, Dr. Christine Goines, and I'm thrilled to introduce our esteemed guest today, Dr. Michael Vitolano. Dr. Vitolano is an executive coach and clinical psychologist whose expertise lies in resilient science. With over 15 years of experience being adjunct faculty at Yale and through his private practice, Dr. Vitolano specializes in helping individuals enhance their psychological growth and development. Today, we're delving into the topic of resilience, particularly exploring how travel can serve as a powerful tool to enhance our resilience as doctors.
Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
So Michael, unlike most psychologists, doctors, or healthcare providers in general who tend to focus on what's wrong with an individual, you like to focus on what's right, you know, personal strengths and resilient traits. What was your journey to offering this unique perspective and focus on resilience?
Great question. And I'm so glad that we're talking about this because resilience is something that I'm like really passionate about and really focused on in my work right now, is and specifically like resilience science, like what does the science tell us about and how can we can apply it to our daily lives. And so I hope the listeners like get something out of it, doctors or whoever. But first of all, can I be a little silly like during this podcast, or do I have to keep it like professional, like researchy, serious? Okay, cool. Good, because I just went to this like workshop on like authenticity that my friend ran. Shout out Dr. Christy Culpepper. She's an amazing psychologist and she's Dr. CC on like Instagram, Facebook, and she's really blowing up right now. And it was called Free After 40. It was a women's conference, which I don't not fit any of those categories. So I'm not sure how I got in, but she's a friend of mine and we went to grad school together and I was like there to support her. And she's all about like authenticity. And that's like a big thing in our field right now. It's kind of like a lot of really good research coming out about like being your authentic self and yeah, not trying to like, you know, fake it anymore. And so, yeah, I'm going to try to be like super authentic so people get to know me and the true me in this podcast. Before I talk about resilience, I want to do my disclosures. So no one is paying me anything. So I have no financial disclosures, but if you want to sponsor me, send the check. I'll take a sponsorship or, you know, sponsor Christine because she's great too. But no, by disclosure, are non-financial. No one's paying me anything. Maybe someday. But I want to disclose like my biases. So like everyone can know like the things that I'm like biased about. And so like kind of put things in perspective. And it's, I think it's just good to like be aware of your biases in, you know, psychology or whenever you're talking about things. So I believe in the body's incredible ability to heal itself. I believe, not from everything, but from like a lot of things, I believe that our thoughts are really powerful. I believe in the mind-body connection, that our mind and bodies are one. I believe in like the good in all people and seeing the good in people and in ourselves. And I'll kind of be talking about that a little bit today. I believe that work is not everything. It's a thing that I do, but it's not who I am. So I'm just as much as a, like my hobbies, I coach lacrosse. I love like hiking, traveling. I'm a friend, brother, but you know, I'm also a psychologist. And yeah, I believe in, I'm fascinated by learning about cultures and languages. And I believe in holistic health, like doing things the old fashioned way, power of community. I believe in boys and girls clubs, community-based kind of stuff, nature and its incredible healing power, growing and cooking your own food, being barefoot, stuff like that. So those are my biases. So like when I talk about things, and I'll present like a lot of research, but just know that I have my biases.
For sure. But no financial disclosures. I appreciate you bringing that. Yeah. important to know. I think it's great that you kind of shed a light on the perspective that you're going to bring to the conversation and what approach you really like to follow and kind of guide your treatment and ideas from. So that's super helpful.
But I keep an open mind. So yeah, I try not to be too biased, but yeah, I have things that I'm biased about, I guess, or believe in.
So from your perspective, can you explain like the concept of resilience as you see it and its importance in the context of healthcare?
Sure. It's a really complicated topic. And I think like I am certainly not an expert. It's something that I'm passionate about. And I think we've only really like scratched the surface of it, but I will do my best to like explain it the way that I understand it. And I try to make things like simple so that like, it can help people understand and, you know, easy to digest, you know, ways. So, you know, to me, resilience is, it's an ability and it's like one's ability to bounce back from whatever happens, a difficult life circumstance or a stressful situation. Something happens to us, and it's our ability to adapt, respond, and really bounce back or cope. An easy way to think about it is like mental fitness or strength or fortitude. And it's not something that's like fixed. So I don't think of like someone as either being like resilient or not resilient, but it's like something that can be developed. And I think of it as like a muscle that like it can be developed when you use it or when it's flexed. So you can build resilience just like you can build muscle in the gym.
Wonderful. So it's this, I like how you talk about the bounce back, you know, like that ability to see a challenge or withstand something that could be problematic or conflict in some kind of way, depending on how, you know, we perceive it, but either way, we can bounce back from it and we can kind of come back to a place of inner strength and stability.
And another easy way to think about it is, you know, why when military soldiers are coming home from war deployment, why do some of them really struggle and develop problems, you know, alcoholism, PTSD, anger problems in relationships, and some don't? And what could explain this like difference? Obviously not everyone, most people don't develop those problems, but some people do. And that's one of the ways that another simple way to think about resilience. So not only as a muscle and like your mental fitness, but when, you know, people have these really difficult or traumatic experiences, why do some people develop these kinds of problems and some people are fine? So there's research on this. And I want to kind of like present like the, like in general, what like the research has converged on this like idea, like what builds resilience, because I think that's probably something the listeners want to know. And it's something that I was very curious about. And it's really contrary what your parents told you, or what at least my parents told me, is like resilience is not developed through like a lifelong struggle, hard work, and just like suffering through life. You know, white knuckling the steering wheel and like just trying to like, you know, persevere. What the research shows is that it's really about relationships. So not to say that hard work and work ethic is not important, but the research is not saying that like a struggling through life makes you a resilient person or builds you resilient. It's about relationships and specifically social support. And so this data has been presented at like APA conferences. The VAs have done studies that soldiers report when they're like higher levels of like cohesion in their units, they were more resilient to mental health problems such as like PTSD. And that was out of the New Jersey VA. The author was McAndrew that presented that study to APA. And so like unit cohesion would be like, remember people, the soldiers felt like they were like really well connected, cooperative, they can depend on each other, stand up for each other. And there was like a correlation between like that cohesion and effective like coping techniques, like specifically like active coping. So like when you see a problem, you go and seek out support and help and solve the problem, versus like avoiding coping would be like the tendency to like ruminate. You have a problem and you just ruminate about it, and rather than like address it head on. So social support and relationships being like the most important thing. Another study came out of BU, public health. So again, social support, connection, resources to cope with stress for the soldiers. And then they also found a variable in addition to social support, emotional hardiness, which was like believing that your life experiences are controllable and manageable, and that the things that happen to us are opportunities for growth. So like a little bit of like growth mindset kind of stuff in there, if people are familiar with that concept.
Yeah, that's really helpful though, because especially I think in the healthcare profession, there's this idea that we're kind of going through this challenging journey. It's really hard. We're struggling. And this is all like making us strong and better for the end. You know, like we're just going to build up our muscles and be able to be better, you know, providers or clinicians or doctors through this experience because of all of this hard work. And it doesn't sound like that's what the science is saying at all. It sounds like the science is saying that's not necessarily what builds resilience, but rather it's about our social connections and our relationship and our ability to seek out support when we need it and to not like stew in our own discomfort or pain or suffering, but to actually reach out and ask for help and support others when they need help. Like that connection is what really builds our resilience.
Absolutely. I think you nailed it. Which I was surprised to find out, because the training program that I was in bred like a very different culture, like this culture of like, you know, just being a martyr. You come into work when you're sick. You don't call in sick, you show up sick, and then, you know, you'd be sent home. And that's, you know, I've worked in hospitals and I know you have too. And that was my kind of experience. And I've talked to people and it really is a toxic culture in hospitals. I love hospitals. I think they're great, but I disagree with the culture there. And then some of the models for the training programs where they really like, you know, push you to work like long hours and work when you're sick. And, you know, if you call in sick, someone else has to come in on their day off and like, you know, the guilt about that. I think that's kind of really messed up. But, you know, being able to, you know, promoting a culture where people ask for help when they need it, they can rely on each other, you know, teamwork, building relationships. And I'll talk about some of that stuff too, like stuff that builds resilience at work. So, and I don't mean to compare like hospitals and war, but I've worked in hospitals and it's a goddamn war zone at time out there. Like people are pulling lines, they're yelling, it's loud, there's crying, code blue, you know, beepers going off. I've been there in the trenches, but not to compare the two, but sometimes it does feel like a war zone. And for all the, you know, doctors and nurses that are working out there, I feel you if it feels like that sometimes.
And I could especially think of, you know, when the pandemic started and how hospitals, you know, must have been during that time. And I'm sure some other areas and hospitals still might be struggling in a lot of ways or be having a high capacity. And that might be similar, you know, not exactly like war, but definitely stressful, challenging situations where there's a lot happening at once. And there's a lot to cope with from a provider point of view. So when it comes to travel, I know you are also a world traveler. Can travel serve as an effective means for combating burnout and enhancing resilience? And if so, how?
That's a great question. Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about why. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about burnout. So I experienced burnout. It led to, you know, quitting my job working in the hospital. And it's actually kind of like a funny story. I was sitting in the chair of my department's, I was attending a psychologist at Seattle Children's Hospital. So I worked there like 4 years. I did my fellowship and then they hired me on as attending. I was sitting in the chair of the department's office, and she was like asking me, she's like, do you read those neuropsych reports? And I was like, yeah, I actually write them. She's like, do you find them helpful? And I was like, yeah, you know, I think sure. Like, you know, that was my training, you know, like assessment and writing these psych, you know, reports, these long, like, you know, 10 page, you know, data, you know, IQ, cognitive memory, all this stuff, all the neuropsych stuff. And she's like, well, I think they're useless. You know, nobody reads them. Nobody understands them. Like, you know, people get these like 10 page reports and like, they don't know how to interpret them. Like, I was like, I write those reports, you know, for the clinic I work in the hospital. And she's like, well, that's just like, you know, my opinion. And I was like, you know what? There is something I don't like about them. Psychologists are really good at telling people what's wrong with them. You know, 10 pages of, you know, what, you know, what's wrong or what you should fix or change. And then like, if you ever read those reports, it's like one sentence, one line that's like positive. It's like, you know, strengths, you know, in like a clinical, you know, case conceptualization, it's like, you know, strengths and talents, you know, about a person. And it's usually like, you know, one sentence. And I just kind of thought like, man, why should we be telling people what's wrong with them? Like psychologists like should be telling people what's with them and like, you know, identifying unique talents and abilities and things like our strengths and building upon them. You know, like playing to people's strengths. So she's like, yeah, kind of like resilience, huh? And I'm like, yeah. She's like, interesting. And I was like, yeah, I guess it is kind of like resilience. And then she was like, why are you here? What are you doing in my office? And I was like, well, by the way, I quit. And she's like, oh, like, why? I was like, oh, I just got burnt out. I, you know, I can't, you know, do this job anymore, you know, well. And she's like, oh, okay. Like, completely understanding, you know, she's like, well, you do a lot here. And yeah, that was the day that, you know, simultaneously, I think I like got interested in resilience and, you know, helping people understand and uncover like what's right with them and kind of pivoting into like helping people figure out what's right with them, what their strengths and talents and abilities are and changing the game in that way. And also that was the day that I quit my job to go traveling. So that's kind of how I got interested in it.
So how has travel served as, or how can it serve as a means for enhancing resilience?
Yeah. So,
or how did it help you beat burnout?
Yeah. So I think taking breaks from work definitely helps me. And I'm certainly not speaking for everybody, but I think taking breaks can be really helpful, you know, like sabbatical, time off, vacations, all those kinds of things. And that's really what has helped, you know, kind of me, you know, figure out how to sustain this kind of work is, you know, taking time off from work. And, you know, the data on physicians and burnout, and I'm not going to like, I'm not the doom and gloom guy. Remember, I'm like the resilience guy. So I don't like, I tell people what's right. I don't tell them like what's wrong. But I don't know if you saw New England Journal of Medicine about the hours that physicians work, like increasing number of hours that you work, more depression and burnout scores. And that was looking at like first year physicians, intern year physicians. And basically like the more hours you work, the more they were reporting like how depressed they were. But I'm not here to talk about like that, but I just want to I looked at that data and then it's like, you know, it's very, very much like a positive core association. And then like at the higher levels of hours, it just like the line gets steeper. So like the more hours you work, the more depressed you get faster, I guess would be the way to like say it. So I think taking time off, and obviously I'm a proponent of working less, but that's one of my biases. I'm not saying that's for everybody, but I'm certainly biased about that. And I think the data suggests it. So like the doctors that work less hour, or at least intern doctors that were able to work less hours, were reporting not as much like depression and burnout. So
I mean, yeah, of course, we have had similar, you know, aspects of our journeys. But I was just thinking about the data that you just were just mentioning. And that data is really consistent with my life. You know, the least hours, you know, when I work less hours, I'm happier, you know, and I find more fulfillment, more meaning, more purpose. I have more space to grow and to give in the work that I do when I work less hours, as opposed to only working and really having time for nothing else. So it's really interesting to see the correlation between the amount of hours and that kind of steep increase in burnout and depression.
So what does that mean for like medicine and healthcare and hospitals, I think we need more people so that people can work less hours so that, you know, it can be more sustainable. So we need more doctors and nurses and healthcare providers so that they can like share the load and work less hours. And also I'm not the one to change it because no one's going to listen to me, but I think the training programs, this data that came out in New England Journal of Medicine shows that the median hour of working for interns, you know, it was 67 hours per week is the equivalent of, you know, a change in depression score, pretty high. Cause there was like, you know, it goes up and then it like jumped at around like 50, 55 hours, not jumped, but it like got the line got, the data gets steeper, you know, getting more depressed for every extra hour that you work. So maybe, I don't know, they've like tried to cut back on the hours. I think there was like some laws that got passed a little while ago. I don't know, because that was, you're probably more familiar with the training programs, but I think less hours is a good thing. I think you can still get the same training without working people more hours. Like I guess that's my bias or that's opinion, but I think the data kind of supports that. Like, are doctors becoming better doctors at their 67th hour than they are of the week?
In the world of medicine, where every decision can change lives, your peace of mind is crucial. This is where Pattern steps in. Imagine insurance made simple, fast, and personalized just for you. With Pattern, you're not just getting disability and life insurance, you're ensuring your future and protecting your greatest asset, your income. In the past 10 years, Pattern has transformed the way over 20,000 doctors secure their financial well-being. Discover the simplicity of securing your future at patternlife.com or click the link in the description.
So travel for you, it sounds like, was an opportunity to work less, was an opportunity to have more space, to take a break, to focus on other things.
Yeah. So I took a long break and it was great. I loved it. So, and I think that travel can help prevent burnout and with resilience, but I think taking breaks is good from work, vacations, time off, things like that. For me, I think I was trying to think about like how it affected like and built resilience in me and did it. I think I became a more patient person. And I don't know if you notice this, like when you meet travelers, like they tend to have like a level of like, you know, patience and like, they're usually good listeners. I mean, waiting for buses that I did not know when they would, if ever, come. And I had like no choice because like I'm in the middle of nowhere, like just at a, I mean, there's no bus stops in Latin America, but you know, like the place where the bus is going to, you know, go by, and just kind of sitting on that side of the road and be like, it could come next, like in the next hour, and it could like come in like 4 hours, and then it starts raining. And then, you know, you basically like, you have no choice but to be patient. So, and that was something that I needed I was not a very patient person, like my life. So that was like really helpful learning. I think I learned patience would be the first thing. Sometimes you just got to abandon the plan and pivot. And I think that could be good for like physicians, you know, like when you're like used to like treatment protocols and doing things like in a regimented way. I'm not saying that doctors are rigid. That's not what I'm trying to say, but I think it definitely helps. Like traveling has helped me personally with flexibility. And I think it could help people, other people as well. I think it's fine to have a plan when you try. Like, I'm not a big planner when I travel, but I think it's fine to like have a plan and go into a trip with a plan. I think it's great to organize and think, especially if you have limited time, but always be ready to pivot and, you know, abandon the plan. Your hotel's not ready. You got to bring your luggage to the beach and like just be, you know, hang out on the beach with your luggage. I've had so many stories like about that. I think that's like a great experience of kind of like just going with the flow and being flexible. And I've also learned to like, I don't know what this would be called, but like I learned about trust and to trust my own guts and instincts. So I've learned to like put my trust in other people. And I know my mom was like, really, one of the things she was worried is just like, you know, you're such a trusting individual. Like, I don't want you to like, you know, like just like trust people and then something bad happened. And I'm like, so I'm not talking about that. Like, I wouldn't like blindly trust, you know, everyone. But if you never trust people, you're never going to have like, you know, a great experience because you have to, you know, like let go and enjoy the ride sometimes. And, you know, some of the best experiences I've had traveling was when I, you know, put my trust in, you know, like local people that I met to invite me into their homes or cook me a meal or take me somewhere really cool, but also to trust like my own instincts and like when something didn't feel right for me, not necessarily like I knew why, but I just had that like gut feeling in me to pivot and abandon and, you know, leave a situation that I just didn't feel like was safe or didn't feel was right. And you'll feel it like in your, in your gut, it feels in your stomach. Sometimes it feels like you have to like go to the bathroom or you feel like butterflies in your stomach. That's what I'm talking about. Trust your gut. Sometimes we kind of refer to it as like the unconscious, when your like body feels something before you like realize why or what it is. Maybe you can't even explain it. But I definitely developed that trusting my instincts and that, I guess, awareness, maybe I would call it. What would you say?
No, I think awareness is definitely a really great word. And it's interesting that a lot of the benefits that you've noted from your experience of traveling and how it's benefited you and how it's helped you beat burnout and built your resilience, they're very similar to mine. So I know it's part of being, you know, an avid traveler that, you know, the flexibility, you have to be flexible. And you gave some really great examples that most travelers who have traveled far and wide, and especially in, you know, more remote spaces could relate to. But having a plan, which I like to do, I used to be more of a planner before I became a traveler, a full-time traveler, because you recognize that that trust you have with yourself, you can trust yourself that you'll go when you want to go, you'll stay when you need to stay, you'll figure it out as you go. And even that connection that you talk about with fellow travelers and locals and building those relationships, I think it's also a lot about trusting yourself, because you trust yourself in those relationships to have, you know, certain amount of boundaries, to know when to let go, to know when to be more vulnerable so that you can have a deeper connection. And all of that gets enhanced. It's such great practice when you're traveling.
Yeah. I'm sure you have some stories about like having to pivot and having to change plans and, you know, how your resilience has been built too through your experiences.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and it might even come up around like when more serious things happen, like more than when you don't know if your bus is ever coming, which that's definitely happened. But when I had like a serious medical issue and I had to go to the hospital and I don't have friends in the area, I just got to the area, I don't know anyone in the area. The only person I know is the dentist that I went to just a week ago. And that being the only person I know in that town or country, you know, that person stopped their business, stopped their practice, stayed with me to make sure I got to the hospital, cooked me meals, stayed with me after I got out of the hospital, still checked on me, you know, and made sure I got on the plane to where I was going next because I had to delay my flight because of the emergency. And that had to do with like trusting myself that I could trust someone else in this particular situation. And so it brings me back to the information that you gave earlier about resilience and how that's really being built with the connections that you're forging and that you're fostering as you move along through life. And so I could see, even thinking back to that situation, like, wow, I was building my resilience, even though this was a challenging event.
A lot of problem solving and trying to navigate healthcare and going to a hospital in a foreign country, right? I got stung by not a jellyfish, but what are those things in the water with the spikes? Oh, the sea urchins. I was swimming in Mexico and some waves rolled up and I was coming around these rocks and I didn't want to like get like swept into like the rocks. So I like grabbed onto like a rock to like, kind of like brave myself and like wait for like the set of waves like roll through. Cause you know, like waves come in sets, like, you know, 1, 2, 3 or like, and the rock that I grabbed underneath the water, which I couldn't see, was just like all sea urchins. And so by the time I already had like a hold of it, I was holding it on like, like here. And then I was like, you know, my feet were under the water and then the waves were, and I didn't want to let go of the rock because I didn't want to get swept up against the rocks, the big rocks, and like, you know, hit my head or get like some kind of head injury. And I walked out of the ocean and I was like, oh, that kind of hurts. So I think I like stepped on something, and I had 90 spikes in my right foot and 20 spikes in my left foot. And it took the doctor like 2.5 hours to remove them one by one. I gave me some like, you know, shot of like local anesthetic, and then yeah, pulled them out one by one. Cause like a couple, they'll just like fall out and your body will just reject them, I guess. But yeah, I had 90 in one foot. And so like, and you know, they like release a little bit of poison. So they're like a little stingy. Yeah. And I had my feet wrapped up in gauze, and you know, I was just like, you know, taking antibiotics and you know, just hanging out watching movies in a hostel bed for a few days waiting for my feet to heal. I think that made me stronger. I don't know. But I don't know. But yeah, definitely a lot of problem solving.
Yes, for sure. And it, you know, this, it also makes me think about healthcare in the US, because I navigate so many different healthcare systems around the world. You know, it makes me think of people who do come to the US seeking healthcare where it's not their primary language, is not the place that they're from, and how they navigate a system like that compared to some of the systems that I navigate, particularly with the privilege of being a physician. So I probably have some, you know, understanding, even if it's a different healthcare system, about what could or could not happen. But it's challenging, and it's definitely something to be aware of. So my compassion for people who undergo that experience has definitely been enhanced. What advice do you have for doctors who really want to integrate the lessons learned from travel into their daily lives and their practice to maintain that resilience long term?
That's a great question. What can doctors do to like maintain? So I think it starts with like, so I'm big on like culture. I think I said that in my bias disclosure. I'm really interested in like languages and cultures. I think that leaders in healthcare can, they're the ones that can make changes and start to create a culture for healthcare workers to feel empowered to ask for like what they need. And to, I'm big on asking for help. So like, I'm working on like a recipe for resilience. And like, if you work with me, whether it's business, like coaching or as a therapist, I'm always like helping people build their resilient, like whatever we're talking about, like you're going to walk out a more resilient person, hopefully, or I'm going to at least aim for that. So like leaders in any organization, in a company or in healthcare, can create a culture where workers like feel empowered to ask for like what they need and ask for help. So there's not a culture of like, you know, suffering in silence. And leaders can kind of model this and really try to create this relationships at work and like a culture where people like are encouraged to ask for help. And in a company and in a business, you know, when people are working together on teams and like, you know, bringing people in to like solve problems together rather than people like working in their silos and things like that, things, you know, seem to problems seem to get solved. And, you know, the companies seem to be like more effective when people are like really working together and collaboratively. So creating that culture where like, you know, if people are working together and asking for help, less hours, I think there's some data to support that. But again, I'm biased. So like, you know, if you want to work a lot more hours and make a lot more money and it works like that, I'm not telling people how to live their lives or like what to do. But I think having, especially hours that you're not getting paid for. So let me say it like that. Having boundaries. And like, if you're getting paid for like a 9 to 5, working 9 to 5 and then going home, not checking your email. I see tons of people that are struggling with boundaries at work, responding to emails at night, getting more emails at night because they're responding to their emails at night and like getting expected to work after hours. And so I think boundaries are really important. One of the things, and just because you have a boundary doesn't mean people are going to respect it. I get mocked for my boundaries. I remember not having my email connected to my phone when I worked in the hospital, and I was like the kind of the outlier there. And like, you know, people looked at me funny and like, well, like, what if you have to like check an email, like, you know, at home and things like that. And I was like, well, I just don't. So yeah, figuring out what, you know, and my boundaries aren't necessarily like what other people should be doing, but figuring out what your own boundaries are and, you know, maintaining and holding those. And doesn't mean people are going to respect them, but still, I think it's still important to have them. Something I've changed my mind on, and this is something that I've changed my mind on, because I've always been like, you know, big on like work-life balance, like leaving work at work, coming home, having like, you know, not checking your emails and doing that kind of thing. But the data on having a best friend at work, there was a Gallup survey poll, and they said one of the best things for people in terms of like all these variables, like, you know, work engagement, work satisfaction, is having a best friend at work. And that goes back to the relationship piece. So I've completely changed, you know, your best friend can be at work, and actually having a best friend at work, and this concept of a work husband or a work wife that I'm sure the listeners know about is a really good thing. And I was like, oh yeah, no, like you should leave your work at work, and like you should keep your social life separate from work. But no, having best friends at work is a key to like your job satisfaction and success and all those kinds of things. Fewer accidents at work. People get more done in less time when they're like connected with at least one person at work. They're innovative. They share ideas. They have more fun. So like less burnout probably. And the latest data is that with more people going remote and working remotely, that it's even more important to identify someone as like a best friend or a work husband or work wife. Yeah, as the remote work has increased.
So I need a remote work wife or work husband.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting from what you just said.
Are you big on co-working spaces, or do you like to work in your apartment? You don't use the co-working spaces?
No, because you know, a lot of the type of work that we do is private. So I have to think through that, but I think that those are such really great points to ask for what we need, to not kind of sit, ruminate, and stew in our own struggle or suffering, but to reach out to really foster these relationships, you know, whether we're working in person or we're working remotely, to really tap in and collaborate and form these relationships. Work husband or work wife or work spouse, partner, best friend, whatever you want to call it, get one. Working less, which, you know, that's like part of my mission, is to help doctors to work less and live anywhere. So working less is a big part of that, right? And the data suggests that, you know, help us shine a light on. The data suggests that it can be a really helpful thing. And then also having those boundaries, really setting the precedent for yourself in terms of the type of lifestyle you want to have when you're at work and when you're outside of work. And I really like something that you said earlier as well, like you can have a plan, and having a plan, whether it's for your trip or for your life or for your work, having a plan is great. But part of resilience is also in that flexibility of being able to abandon the plan and pivot when you need to, and being able to rely on other people to support you in that process. So I think those are really awesome points.
Yeah. And I think those are like generalizable or transferable for physicians and the work that they, cause like sometimes you're doing like a treatment plan and like, this is the, you know, the first line treatment, or this is like, you know, and the patient presents in a very, or has a very like strange reaction or presents differently, and you have to like, you know, abandon the plan and, you know, think outside the box and, you know, talk to people, ask for help. And yeah. I think that's, and that adaptability and like flexibility, I think is something I grown with from travel. And so, yeah, I think there's some transferable, like kind of life skills there that, you know, it's good to be flexible.
Absolutely. Well, Michael, I so appreciate you taking the time to share your experiences and your expertise with us today. And before we wrap up, do you have any final thoughts or advice for our listeners who really want to continue enhancing their psychological growth and development, even as they serve others and travel the world?
So we talked a lot about relationships. I want to say that not all stress is bad, that there are good sources of stress, and some of the resilience, like specifically like stress resilience, is built up from sources of good stress. And there's like, you know, biological explanations for that. The process is called hormesis. And an easy example of that in humans is like exercise. you know, that is a stress on the body, but we know it's a good source of stress. It's healthy for us, and our body, you know, recovers from it, versus bad stress, or what we call like toxic stress. And that would be something that's like not so much like acute and immediate and short term, but something that's like, you know, every day going into an environment that you feel like is toxic, a toxic work environment, a toxic relationship. So like the younger listeners that are listening, if you feel like you're in a situation that feels toxic to you, it very well might be. And that's not a good source of stress. In general, we think that like work is one of those like good sources of stress, as long as it's not like, you know, a toxic environment. But going to work is helpful for people. You know, when people get depressed and they stop going to work, it kind of makes things worse for them. So work is a good thing. Kids going to school, that's a good source of stress, even though school is really stressful for lots of like teenagers. But we know, when it's kind of the same thing, when kids, you know, struggle and they stop going to school, it kind of makes things worse. So there are both good and bad sources of stress. And one way to help identify is working with someone like a psychologist or a psychiatrist like you, because that's like what our expertise is trained. And it's like really nuanced, and there's exceptions to every rule. So like, you know, if you're getting like, you know, bullied at school, like, you know, and like, you know, physically like hurt, then that's probably not like, you know, that's not a good source of stress, right? Like, you don't want to send your kid so there's like very nuanced, and working with a professional like us can kind of help identify like the good sources of stress and then the bad or the toxic sources of stress in our lives.
For sure. Thank you so much. Yeah. And for those who are actually wanting to learn more and even work with the amazing Dr. Michael Vitolano, where can our listeners find you?
I'm not hard to find. I got a website. It's michaelvitolano.com for business, executive coaching, and therapy and psychological services. I'm on Instagram. I think it's Michael Vitolano PhD. Yeah. Where I post like interesting new studies on resilience science that kind of come out that I think people will find interesting and applicable in their lives, like really simple, easy to digest things. Like, I don't dive too deep into the technical aspects of it. Yeah. So those two. I have a YouTube, but I don't really use it anymore. I was doing some videos and things like that on resilience. But yeah, so my website and my Instagram page.
Well, that concludes today's episode of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. Thank you so much. I so appreciate you, Michael, for joining us, for your insight, for your expertise. Thank you all for being with us. Today's information has been extremely impactful. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to connect, you can learn more about me at physiciansguidetodoctoring.com/Dr. Goines. And have a great day. Thank you all.
Thanks again from Heidi. Elevate your practice with a free AI scribe, zero cost, HIPAA compliant, and time saving. Ready to swap? We've got you covered for past AI scribe expenses. Head to HeidiHealth.com, get started, and make your practice the envy of every stethoscope in town.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it or like it. Or comment on a social media post, or write us a 5-star review, something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee, and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice, or financial advice, or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.